It's a matter of very great delight, and I can think of it as nothing less than a high honor that I have the privilege of presenting these addresses during these Sunday afternoons or evenings. But in my opinion, we as Americans, we as Christians, are face to face with the most serious problem, the most serious question, with which either America or the Christian faith itself has been confronted. In the case of America, in 200 years. In the case of the Christian faith, since the hour that Jesus hung upon his cross on Calvary. There have been other times, for instance, when the Moors came surging up out of North Africa and threatened Christian civilization. There was a time when the Goths and the Visigoths came down from the north threatening the Holy Roman Empire. There was a time when Tamerlane and Genghis Khan and others from the Far East threatened all of the achievements of Mediterranean civilization. But there has never been a time, there has never been a time when the whole world was face to face with the necessity of deciding so far-reaching, so creative, and so determinative a question as we face today in the decision as to whether or not this world is going to be ruled with the idea represented by the old Jewish words, "Thus saith the Lord," or these other words represented by Karl Marx, "Das Kapital." The thing that I'm going to be saying this afternoon may not immediately seem to be so closely related to this question of communism as the things I'll be saying on the other Sunday afternoons, but it's quite impossible for us to come to any decision. It's quite impossible for us to consider the strife, the controversy, the struggle that is on, unless we understand certain underlying causes. Let's begin with two or three rather simple, and I think simple, but very basic assumptions. We've come together this afternoon as Christian people. And the Christian man is a different man. He sets out from a different base. He sets out for a different purpose. He sets out with a different mind. The man in whom there reigns even some small part of the mind of Christ cannot think about this world as that man does who thinks of it only in terms of political power, economic opportunity, or racial superiority. I heard Alan Walker, the great Australian evangelist, say one time, "If we seem to be out of step, remember, we are hearing the drum beats of another drummer." We come together this afternoon then as Christian people. And that means that as Christians, we have the right to arrive at an independent conclusion. Over on the north side of the old building, there is a very remarkable epigram, there's a very remarkable statement on a bulletin board. "Freedom is the privilege of making your own choices and making up your own mind." I do not think I've quoted it precisely, but that's what it means. That's what freedom means. That rests down upon the very important and very inescapable doctrine of the sanctity of the individual. Freedom. Freedom is the privilege of making up one's own mind. We come together then as Christians, declaring our right to make up our mind on the basis of our Christian convictions. I think a second thing, one of the first responsibilities of every Christian, of any Christian, is to understand his generation. There are so many of us that are thinking of the present situation, for instance, in terms of the political ideas and the political beliefs and the political dogmas and doctrines of 75 or 100 or 150 years ago. The first responsibility of any Christian is to understand his own generation. R.A. Tawney, whom I think is one of the greatest of our modern British historians, tells the story of an English nobleman who became very irate something like 100 years ago and complained bitterly to his minister, saying, "Things have come to a pretty pass in England if a man's religion is going to interfere with his private conduct." That was the attitude. If a man believes certain religious doctrines, if a man subscribed to certain creeds, that was all religion expected of him. We've come a long way since then. But today men are saying, things have come to a pretty pass if a man's religion is going to interfere with his political convictions, his political opinions. Somebody said the other day of a certain man, he prays the most interesting Lord's Prayer you ever heard. I said, well, what is that? He prays, O Lord, thy kingdom come, if it can come while the Republican Party is in power. Contrast that with a Democrat who'd say, while a Democrat was in power. The Christian prays for an understanding of his generation. Sometimes that means a criticism of the party in power. Sometimes it means approval. But it means that the church today cannot deliver a Christian message that is not related to the circumstances and the conditions of the times in which he lives. I traveled a number of years ago over the area and down the route it is said to have been followed by Daniel Boone. I think you're all of you probably familiar with the story of old Daniel. Somebody found him getting ready to move. Said, what's the matter, Dan? He said, there's another white family moved in over there 50 miles east and things are getting too crowded. In those days, a man could enjoy a certain independence of opinion, certain independence of action. But today, when we're living at close range, a man's responsibility to his neighbor stands alongside of his responsibility to his God and to himself. And you cannot dismiss your neighbors today. I heard an old veteran preacher of another denomination standing before a great company of folk last Sunday morning and saying, when Jesus said, go ye into all the world, he was declaring for a revolution. For to the Jew of Galilee, the world ended 4 miles north of Capernaum. For a Jew of Jerusalem, the world ended at the Jordan River and at the Mediterranean. But when Jesus spoke of the world, he had in mind Europe, Africa, North America, South America, Asia, Australia, the islands of the sea. We've come to the point in our Christian thinking, in our Christian responsibility, when we cannot discharge our duty longer as Christians by being interested only in the little circle of which we're a part. 50 years ago, there was a very remarkable publication in America. I wish it were continuing. It was called The Ram's Horn. Frank Beard, the cartoonist, drew a picture for The Ram's Horn once, and I've never forgotten it. Here was an elderly man and his wife, together with a younger man and his wife, sitting at the dinner table. A very wonderful meal spread out, and the old man was returning thanks and saying, Lord, bless me and my wife, my son John and his wife, us four and no more. Amen. That day has passed. That day has passed. I saw another interesting picture the other day. A picture of two monkeys in a cage at the zoo. One of them was defleeing the other. Another of the pictures said, no, we don't believe in foreign missions. We have enough to do right here at home. We've gotten past the place where our Christian responsibility ends at our front gate. We've gotten past the place where our Christian responsibility ends at the city borders. We've gotten past the place where our Christianity and our Christian responsibility ends at our national borders. I said that we've come together tonight as Christian people. Let me say then the second thing. Christian people who have inherited from Jesus a concern for the entire world. Let me say a third thing, a rather shocking thing perhaps, but I believe a true thing. An ignorant Christian is a sinful Christian. When Jesus said, "Thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all thy mind," he meant exactly that. Not that we were to love the Lord with all of our prejudices, not with all of our preconceptions, not with all of the doctrines and dogmas of our fathers. These things are important. They're valuable. But thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all thy mind. And if it was ever necessary for a man to express his Christian integrity in clear thinking and in honest thinking, this is the time. Having said all of this, I want to talk about the revolution of rising expectations. I want to begin the discussion by the statement that the world, 3 billions of the population, with a population of 3 billions, now 103 nations organized in the United Nations, the world is in the process of changing its mind. The world is in the process of moving over from one concept to another, from one social pattern to another, from one culture to another. And the tremendous problem involved in this is, who is to be the authority? What is to be the authority in the new world? Jesus on one occasion said, "The poor you have with you." And poverty is as old, perhaps, as the race. It's been a commonplace in all centuries. And the unfortunate part of it is that the world has taken it for granted, and it has been assumed that there could never be anything but a poverty-stricken world. But all over the world, there is a growing conviction today that a poverty-stricken world is a world that is failing. A poverty-stricken world is a world that's unnecessary. An underfed world is a world that need not be. Men are turning their hearts and their minds to the question of how these things can be eliminated, how a new world can be built. As I've tramped about over the face of the earth, as I've read, and I think I've read extensively, there are four horsemen of disaster with which we have to deal. First of all, there's the question of disease. Let's take the case of malaria as a single illustration. 2,500,000 deaths from malaria every year. What does that mean? Approximately 250 millions of people tonight infected with malaria. Once that a man's become infected with malaria, he can reasonably anticipate that he will only be able to work about 35% out of a year. It means that the strength he'll be able to give to a task is less than 40% of the normal expected strength. 250 millions of cases of malaria means the subtraction of almost 200 million individuals from the working force of the world. You subtract 200 millions of people from the working force of the world, you've depleted the food supply of the world. You've depleted the strength of any nation affected. Let me give you a single illustration in this connection. I was traveling through one of the rural districts of Sudan and saw a group of buildings that looked like they were relatively new. They were all of them thatched and made of reeds. I said to my guide, "What's that?" He said, "That's a malaria control unit." Some few years ago, the World Health Organization, organized under the United Nations, decided to make a test in this matter of malaria. Because Ceylon was an island and it could be more or less restricted as an experiment to Ceylon, An investment was made in DDT. A corps of scientifically trained individuals were assigned to the task. And within the space of 11 months, the incidence of malaria in Ceylon was reduced from 65% of the total population to a little less than 5%. Within the space of 3 years, the rice crop of Ceylon doubled. I could go on and discuss it at length. Something of the same experiment occurred in Greece, but because Greece had contiguous territory that could not be controlled, the results were not so spectacular. I was down at Cape Canaveral in Florida some 4 or 5 weeks ago. A friend of mine, helping me about, said to me, "We're spending billions of dollars here in Canaveral." And then he added this, "It'll cost $1 billion at least to get one man to the moon. And $1 billion spent in the eradication or the elimination of malaria would solve the problem of malaria in every country in the world within the space of 1 year and save 25 millions of lives." I do not want to seem to be critical this afternoon, but if there could be such a personality as Uncle Sam, representing all of us, and if he were to come before the judgment bar of God, I wonder if it might possibly be true that God would say to Uncle Sam, "I gave you $1 billion. I had 300 millions of my children suffering from malaria. How did you spend that billion?" And Uncle Sam would say, "We got a man to the moon." And I wonder what God would say. I wonder what God would say. Or take in the case of yaws, or of leprosy, or of tuberculosis, or of cancer. What do you suppose is the opinion of God on the expenditures of the world tonight? In the second place, we face the terrible disaster, the terrible threat of hunger. An official commission appointed by the Indian government a few years ago made a report to the Indian government just 2 years ago. They'd made the most careful study and the most careful examination of the situation that could be made. They came back with the report that the average man, woman, or child of India had 15% less food, 15% less food today than the fathers of those children had in 1945 at the close of the war. This commission went on further to say that with the population of the world exploding as it is and our numbers multiplying, it could be reasonably expected that that food consumption, the food supply, would be further decreased at the rate of 1 to 2% per year, with the result that by 1985, the average Indian would be trying to get along on approximately 70% of the food of today. And when I tell you that the food intake, the caloric intake of the average Indian today is 1,450 calories, which was the standard set by Germany for her concentration camps, you get something of an idea of the problem of hunger in our world. Between 65 and 70% of the world went to bed hungry last night. I'll never forget dear old Bishop Robinson standing in my pulpit in Minneapolis saying, as they looked out over a great audience. Oh, you lucky, 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 lucky Americans. The probabilities are that there isn't a one of you hungry. You're all well-dressed. You live in lovely homes. Said he, this is the first audience that I have faced in 17 years where one half of the people were not hungry. One half had come without food to the service. I do not dare elaborate. I only mention this question of poverty. I dare only mention the matter of ignorance, disease, hunger, poverty, ignorance. And now very suddenly, the people of the underdeveloped areas of the world have come to the conclusion that these things are not necessary. That every man has a right to food. That every man has a right to health. That every man has a right to know. And all over the world, the underdeveloped peoples of the world are determined to have these things. How are they going to get them? That remains to be seen. A young Egyptian said to me in Cairo, "We're going to make a lot of mistakes." "I'm perfectly sure of that," said he. "We're going to make a lot of mistakes. But from this time on, we're going to make our own mistakes and pay for them. Up to this time, we've been paying for the mistakes that other people have made for us." The peoples of the underdeveloped areas of the world have determined to take matters over into their own hands and undertake to solve their own problems. Here's a revolution. For hundreds of years, the pagan faith, the non-Christian faiths, the philosophers have said to the people of the underdeveloped areas, "There's nothing that you can do about your hunger. There's nothing that you can do about your disease. There's nothing you can do about your ignorance. All these things are the will of the gods." And now suddenly men have come to the conclusion that there is something that they can do about these things. There is something that they can do about their wretchedness. And they propose to do it. There's no very general agreement as to what that something is. The man who makes the cruel and the deceptive promise of communism, for instance, can get a following among people who are not trained in economics and politics. It's very probable that the people of the underdeveloped areas of the world will make some serious mistakes. But you could put this thing down as being true. They are determined to do something about their wretchedness. Why this new determination? Why this new determination? I think there are four reasons. In the first place, Christian missionaries have gone to the ends of the earth with the news that every man is made in the image of God. Once that a man believes that he's made in the image of God, he does not accept poverty, nor ignorance, nor disease, nor hunger readily. More than that, he's not willing to accept slavery regularly and easily. You probably read the story, if you haven't heard the story, of a group of Oriental workmen. They were for the most part ignorant. They were all of them poor. Some of them were diseased. They had the feeling that the working conditions under which they were compelled to labor represented injustice and unfairness. And they marched into the presence of their employer and said, "We protest, and we are men like you." There's something holy in that declaration. Men who've discovered their own dignity, men who've discovered their own divinity, men who've discovered that they're made in the image of God, are now determining to do something about their wretchedness. Alongside the thing that I've said is another thing that must be said, related. Under the leadership of the Rockefeller Foundation, one of the most amazing, one of the most marvelous, one of the most praiseworthy institutions on the face of the earth, under the leadership of the Rockefeller Foundation, under the leadership of the Seventh-day Adventist Church, under the leadership of the medical missions of the various denominations, Catholic and Protestant, the idea is somehow getting into the minds of the peoples of the underdeveloped areas of the world that disease is unnecessary. A missionary told me the story of an old black woman who listened to him preach in a little mud village. She listened attentively, and when he had finished the sermon, she arose without a word to anyone, went to the little mud hut in which she lived, gathered up an armful of the old wooden gods, threw them into the river and said, "I've always believed that there was a God like that somewhere, and nobody ever told me that my dream was true." This has been the effect of the preaching of Christian missions. This has been the effect of the organization of hospitals and sanitaria and such. It's been my privilege to see Seventh-day Adventist hospitals in, I suppose, 50 foreign countries. I'm not friendly to Seventh-day Adventist theology. I'm not making any plea for their theology, but I am saying that their hospitals all over the world, reared in the name of Christ, have raised the hopes in the minds of men that there was some deliverance from disease. An interesting thing, one of the very first things that appears in the program of any one of these new governments is a national health program. When the health minister of the Ceylonese government received the offer from the United Nations for this DDT experiment of which I have spoken, it was not necessary for him to submit the matter to a plebiscite. They didn't have to have a special election. They didn't even have to have a session of the legislature. He had the authority. It was put into operation immediately. There isn't a new nation in the world today, either in Africa or Asia, that isn't demanding as one of the very first steps of the new government that it shall establish a health program. The world has suddenly become health conscious. Men are not all trained in Louis Pasteur's theory of the microbic origin of disease, but there has spread through the underdeveloped areas of the world the conviction that people do not need to be sick and they're determined to be well. It's been the process, it's been the product of this missionary medical program. There's a third thing. Modern methods and modern media of communications have carried to the ends of the earth news concerning the way in which the developed peoples of the world live. Way back in a little village in Thailand, I suppose I was at least 250 miles from Bangkok, in a tiny little silk shop on a teakwood table, I found a half a dozen or more American fashion magazines. 17, Amzel, and a series of them. They were pretty badly outdated and they were well thumbed. They'd had a lot of reading. I made some comment about them to the little demure Thailand girl who is serving as the sales girl at the moment. She spoke a little bit of English. I wish I could imitate her dialect. I cannot. But she said, "All our women want to dress like your American women." I'm not going to tell you what I thought, but there is something significant about it. There's something very significant about it. There probably were not 1% of the women of Thailand who could even name the name of the American Secretary of State, but they all wanted to dress like Jackie. What's that mean? It means that a new media of communication has developed in the slick magazine, And nobody knows how far the influence of American fashions go. Nobody knows how far the influence of Hollywood goes. I've seen the tens of thousands crowding into the picture houses in 20 nations among the so-called underdeveloped. A picture house that opens at 7:30 in the morning and doesn't close until 2:30 the next morning, playing seven or eight times, presenting the pictures that you and I are questioning. The media of communication, including radio, eventually to include television, is having the effect of carrying to the ends of the earth a new concept of what life can be. And all of this is having the effect of producing this revolution of rising expectations. I remember the young man of Tehran who said to me, at that moment he was driving his employer's car, he said to me, "Some of these days before I die, I'm going to own a car." Well, I leave it to you to decide whether or not this is the greatest ambition possible for a young man of Tehran. All I'm undertaking to say is that the moving pictures, the slick magazines, the daily press, the radio, that tell the story of American boys with their hot rods and their private cars, is having an effect upon the youth of the world. I'm not back so very long from an extended trip that took me around the world into something like 25 or 30 countries. I've forgotten the number. I don't know if I ever counted them. In every country into which I went, young people in one way or another said to me, "Is there any chance of getting to the United States for an education?" And I've seen the new universities in 20 nations. One of the very first institutions that a new nation launches is a university. And not the least important thing about that university is this, that these universities are now open to young women. And I've seen girls in laboratory smocks working alongside their brothers with the same test tubes and retorts and Bunsen burners. And that's something new. Something new! Out of the 133,000 engineers that graduated from Russian universities last spring, 31,000 were young women, chemical engineers, electrical engineers, civil engineers, and such, even a few mechanical engineers. All over the world, the new educational standards, the new health standards, the new literacy standards, the new media of communication, have awakened ambitions in the minds of the people who, previous to now, have never known anything except wretchedness. Now I come to a very significant and to me a very painful fact, but a fact nevertheless. Asia particularly, also Africa, have been colonial continents under the authority, for the most part, of European governments for the last 300 years. Colonialism as a political fact is dead. With the exception of Portuguese Africa and Macau having been ended by Mr. Nehru's action of a few weeks ago, with the exception of Portuguese Africa, Africa today is a new continent with new governments in a new way. All of the evils of colonialism, and there were evils, developed under capitalism. But I'm not the one to complain about capitalism in its entirety. The capitalists have gone into these lands and they've dredged out harbors, they've built railroads, they've organized banks and import systems. They've organized schools. They've organized, in some respect at least, public health. The contribution that the colonial powers have made to the underdeveloped areas of the world is an enormous contribution. But today, without training, the man in the loincloth has never been trained as an economist. This man in the loincloth is today blaming the European powers and the capitalists for the hunger and the disease and the poverty and the ignorance under which he and his fellows have suffered. The complaint is unjustified again and again. But you and I must face the facts. These things did exist under capitalism. And the underdeveloped peoples of the world today are saying that capitalism was to blame. The fact that they're mistaken is in part our responsibility. But nevertheless, that's what they're saying. That capitalism was to blame. And if they're searching for something other than capitalism, is it surprising? Hardly. The second thing in the same connection, all of the evils to which the underdeveloped areas of the world are heir today have developed at the same time that the white man has been in authority. The result is that the peoples of the underdeveloped areas of the world are blaming the white man for a large part of their wretchedness. And along with that goes a second fact. When Jesus of Nazareth is taken into a color area of the world by white missionaries, he's looked upon as a white man's God. One of the greatest things that the World Council of Churches did at New Delhi a few weeks ago was to lend new emphasis and describe new importance to the young churches, that is, the churches, the Christian churches of Burma, of Thailand, of India, of Ceylon, of Africa, and such. But all over the world, the Christian faith today suffers the handicap of being considered, wrongly of course, but considered by the peoples of those areas as a white man's faith. And when we've tried to lay, and when we try to lay the Christian faith down upon these people, they say it's more effort of the white man to dominate. The accusation is false. The true motive is ignored. But the fact represents the problem with which we must be familiar, and the reaction must be the attitude with which we must be patient. To win the world, we must convince the world of our sincerity. We must convince the world of our interracial, our international concern for all men. In this thing, we're being defeated from time to time here at home. Let me give you an illustration of what I mean at that point. A black ambassador of a young African nation appeared in Washington a short time ago. He came with his family. He was to represent his nation. He'd had no ambassadorial experience, for his nation had never known before independence. He came as the ambassador of a nation. He found it impossible to rent a house outside a segregated district. One night, in a fashionable restaurant where he attempted to dine, he suffered certain indignities at the hands of the proprietor of the restaurant. And the ambassador of this African government, angered, immediately got in touch with the representative of his government in New York at the United Nations. He described his experiences, and within a few hours, that African representative in the United Nations voted against the United States. Not because of the failure of Dean Rusk, but because of the failure of a restaurant man and a landlord. The thing that I'm attempting to say in this connection, beloved, is a very simple thing. Until democracy is true democracy inside the United States, it is not ready for export. These two facts, the present situation is developed under capitalism. The present situation is developed under white men. These are facts that cannot be ignored. All over the world, the discontent among the underdeveloped peoples is mounting. They're determined to do something. There's an enormous struggle on today for the mind of the world. The struggle between what is represented as the East and what is represented as the West. And I'm here to say to you, good friends, unless the Western democracies can persuade the underdeveloped areas of the world that their faith is reasonable, their attitude sincere, and their hearts clean, communism will take over. It becomes so simple a matter, for instance, as serving on a jury, or a racial issue, or an oppression issue is at stake in Glendale, or in San Bernardino, or my own hometown in Nickerson, Kansas. This is the background of the present struggle. This is the social and the economic and the political background of the greatest struggle through which humanity has ever gone. This is the backdrop against which the peoples and the nations of the world are going to decide their destinies for the next 500 years. You see, it's not merely a matter of Marxism. It's not merely a matter of communism. It's not merely a matter of the East against the West, or the West against the East. It's a problem of capturing the mind, capturing the legitimate ambitions of the world for the things that we believe to be eternally holy. All that the underdeveloped areas of the world are asking for is what we as Americans asked for in 1776. You probably are aware of the fact that the most quoted man in all the world today, aside from Jesus, is Abraham Lincoln. And again and again and again, I've had nationals from these lands say to me, "Your Thomas Jefferson believed so-and-so. Your Abraham Lincoln said so-and-so. Your Woodrow Wilson said so-and-so. Your Franklin Roosevelt said so-and-so. What do you Americans think?" If ever there was a time for us to believe in a Christian democracy, if ever there was a time for us to make a democracy work, if ever there was a time that the democratic rights of free men were to be safeguarded in the United States of America, this is the time. We're in the midst of a revolution of rising expectations, and we dare not let the world down. We dare not let the world down. Next Sunday night, the meaning of modern communism. The two following Sundays. The last Sunday, I think I will speak on the funeral that Khrushchev is planning.